Hello, and welcome back to the Automotive Podcast, the automotive engineering history podcast. I hope you all are having a great day, and for this week's episode, I decided to talk about the Jaguar E-Type, also known as the XK-E in North America, although I'm probably just going to call it the E-Type throughout the episode, because that's what I know it as, even though that is the European name, and I think that's what most people know it as. The E-Type is a very famous car. It is amazing looking, it had incredible performance for when it was made, and it has a large presence in pop culture, so it's really become a very well-known, very in-demand classic sports car. The Jaguar E-Type was produced for 15 years, starting in 1961, and it went through three different iterations. Although these iterations were not clear-cut, they were not defined by Jaguar, they just kind of continuously changed the car, and roughly the community created these different series, as they're called. So there are Series 1 E-Types, Series 2 E-Types, and Series 3 E-Types. There are even, like, Series 1.5 E-Types, and those are just, again, not official community-created names to kind of designate the different versions of this car. So the general form for the podcast, I'm going to give just a general overview of the E-Type, when it first came out, prices, what made it stand out, and then get a little bit more in the details about each of the series. So starting with just the largest overview of the car, it is the classic sports car of the 1960s, front-engined, rear-wheel drive, although it got some big attention. This car is considered to be one of the best sports cars of all time and was called the, quote, most beautiful car in the world, end quote, by none other than Enzo Ferrari. That is some incredibly high praise. The E-Type was first shown off in 1961 on the 15th of March. Obviously, the E-Type looks amazing. I said that like four times now. It's very sleek, and it really had a different design that made it stand out compared to other cars being produced in the 1960s. It has a very long hood that comes to an end with a round opening at the front, which is a very classic Jaguar look. The headlights are smooth and fit perfectly into the body lines. Bumpers are very limited and consist of only a small chrome cross piece. The back of the car slopes down to a fine point. The whole car just looks like it slips through the air. It is a very powerful design, a very strong design, but also very simple. There's not too much going on, and that's what gives it that great classic look, is it's simple, but with purpose. The car also had a centered twin exhaust, which was a very new concept for the 1960s. No other car had the exhaust pipes exiting the car in this way, and it was surprisingly affordable. Most people, including myself, think of the E-Type as a very expensive car, but that's just today. That's just because it's a classic car that people really like, so it has a high demand. When it first came out, it was really affordable. It cost about $5,620 in 1960. That translates to roughly $49,000 today. So not incredibly cheap, but it doesn't break the bank. And this is what really defines the E-Type. It was a lot of bang for the buck. It didn't cost all that much, but it still provided some pretty incredible features. A quote from a British racing driver goes as such, "Jaguar may not be the best car of its class in the world, but it is incontestably the least expensive of the good cars." The E-Type had features such as independent suspension on both the front and rear of the car, disc brakes on all four wheels, and a rack and pinion steering system that really gave an incredible driving experience, but it didn't cost that much. I mean, it basically set a new standard for sports cars. All the other competitors suddenly had to rework their sports cars to be able to compete with this cheap E-Type that provided some really incredible technology that made it an incredible car. On the rear of the car, the disc brakes were inboard, meaning they were not directly attached to the wheel hubs. At the time, this was a very common brake design for high-performance cars. It was believed to have some benefits, and it does, but the biggest drawback is it's hard to cool the brakes because they're more tucked under the car and have a lot of stuff around them, so it's hard to keep them cool, but they were inboard on the rear. Power was provided by a 3.8-liter inline-six engine that produced 265 horsepower. This allowed the car to reach 150 miles per hour, making it the fastest production car in the world at the time. 0 to 60 was less than 7 seconds. What really allowed the E-Type to be so impressive was its mom and dad, if you will. The cars that had previously been developed by Jaguar that influenced the creation of the E-Type. One of these cars was called the D-Type. And the D-Type was a race car that had managed to win 3 24-hour of Le Mans in a row starting in 1955. So, an incredibly impressive car. And the E-Type sourced a lot of its design from the D-Type. The main advantage provided by the D-Type to the E-Type was the chassis design. The car had a front subframe that supported the engine, then the subframe and the suspension was bolted to the body tub. What this all means is that there was no ladder frame, which made the car very light. The first version weighed 2,900 pounds. The other parent of the E-Type was a prototype that came out in 1957, and this prototype was called the E-1A. The E-1A was smaller than the E-Type, utilizing a smaller engine as well, but it used the new independent rear suspension that would be a big selling point for the E-Type in a few years. So Jaguar really took the cars that they had already made and pick and chose the best of those cars and put it in the E-Type and sold it for pretty cheap. I mean, just think about it. Obviously, they're not the same car, but looking at the D-Type, in a way, you are getting a road-legal version of a 24 hours of Le Mans winning car for under $50,000. I mean, that's nuts. I mean, that's a really, really impressive car for not all that much money. And that's why everybody went absolutely nuts for the Jaguar E-Type. Not only did it look incredible, but it had nuts performance. The E-Type also found its own success in motorsport early on when it was being first built. And this success inspired the creation of a lightweight, purpose-built race car E-Type. The only real difference for this race-specific E-Type was that it had an aluminum body instead of a steel one, so it was just lighter weight.
Jaguar was to produce a lightweight version, and in doing so, ensured the E-Type a place in the record books. Brands Hatch, Hockenheim, Goodwood, Silverstone, Spa, Reims, Le Mans. The list of drivers is equally impressive. Hill, Parks, Salvadori, Prothero, Cunningham, Sturgis.
The E-Type being in motorsport only lasted for a short time. Pretty quickly, it was transformed into more of a GT car, kind of a touring car, something to enjoy on mountain roads and not necessarily be all that competitive. But the early E-Types, the Series 1 E-Types, were pretty successful race cars and had purpose-built race car versions, but this changed relatively quickly. Obviously, these lightweight aluminum versions are pretty rare and worth a lot of money these days. So that's generally what the E-Type is. So now let's go into a bit of the specifics for each series, starting with the Series 1. The Series 1 was built from 1961 to 1968. It used the 3.8-liter inline-six engine, it was fed by SU carburetors, and the engine itself was called the XK6 and actually came from a different car called the XJ150S, which was a different sports car that Jaguar was producing up until the E-Type came out. And so they basically already had a pretty high-performance engine in a sports car. That sports car ended production. They're like, well, we'll just use it in the E-Type. There you go. The XK6 is a dual overhead cam design and has a bunch of different versions with a bunch of different displacements. The displacement from this engine, not specific to the E-Type, but just the engine in general, ranged from 2.4 liters to 4.2 liters. Within the Series 1, the engine had a displacement of 3.8 liters, like I said. The Series 1 was given a 4-speed manual transmission. In fact, all E-Types have a 4-speed manual transmission. It was the standard. In 1964, the engine displacement was increased to 4.2 liters. This did not provide much of a boost to horsepower, but instead gave more torque. The change in displacement also came with other upgrades to the engine. These upgrades included a different crankshaft that allowed the use of better bearings, a new alternator, and electric cooling fans for the radiator. Electric cooling fans are pretty cool because they don't suck power from the engine like a mechanically driven fan. So if you have a car that has a mechanically driven fan and you replace that with an electric one, you'll actually get more performance out of the engine. The 4.2 liter version of the E-Type also had improved brakes and improved electrical systems. But of course, because people like the idea of rarity, the pre-1964 E-Types can be worth more. They were the first, they were the bare bones. But looking at just like, is it a good car? Is it a practical car? The 4.2 liter version probably is, in reality, a more usable car. These early cars can be identified by their flat floors and external bonnet latches. The floors were soon dished to provide more room, and these early flat floor cars are worth more, which I just think is funny. I mean, again, it's all about the rarity. It's all about there's less E-types that have a flat floor, but in reality, who cares if it has a flat floor or a dished floor unless you really, really just care about having something that nobody else does. Other cool features that were included with this Series 1 was a dashboard-mounted ignition and a push-button starter. For some reason nowadays, there seems to be kind of a bit of hype around the idea of push-button starts, but that was the thing in the E-Type from the very beginning in the 1960s, so I thought that was a fun little tidbit. As I said, it had a 4-speed transmission, but this transmission lacked a synchro mesh for first gear. Synchro mesh, or synchro mesh ring, is a ring in the transmission that will automatically match the speed of the input shaft to the speed of the gear being selected. So without synchro meshing, shifting gears is a little bit more delicate. You can't just slam through gears because the input shaft, essentially the engine speed, is different from the wheel speed, and if you just slam it into the gear, you will probably break stuff. Without synchro meshing, there are techniques like rev matching, where you rev the engine up to better match the speed that the transmission wants to be when it gets put into its new gear. You can still do this with synchro mesh transmissions, and it still provides a better shift just because you're matching speeds nicely, but it's not absolutely necessary. If the transmission is not synchro meshed, you pretty much have to do this. The other option for making shifts more smooth is called double clutching. This is when you, let's say you're in second gear and you want to go to third, you put the clutch in, you shift into neutral, you let the clutch out, then you put the clutch back in, you shift into third, and then you let the clutch out. And that just kind of makes you do things a little bit slower and gives time for everything to mesh up nicely and prevent anything from breaking. But obviously, not a very quick method of changing gears. Nowadays, pretty much all cars have synchro mesh transmissions, and double clutching and rev matching can still be used to improve the smoothness of your shifts, but they aren't all that necessary. Of course, this is all manual transmissions. If you have an automatic transmission, you can't do any of that. Anyways, the very first E-types didn't have a synchro mesh only on first gear, so all the other ones did. Just first gear, you had to be a little bit careful with. This changed with late 4.2 liter versions, where first gear would be given a synchro mesh ring. In 1966, a 2 plus 2 version was added. This means that there are two small seats behind the front seat, so it's a four-seater. The 2 plus 2 was longer and had the option of an automatic transmission. In 1967, the Series 1.5 was released. Again, this is an unofficial name. Jaguar didn't come out and say, here's the 1.5 series, but it is a name given to E-types that were produced between 1967 and 1968, so just 1 year. This was a transitional version and had a few small changes. Rocker switches replaced the toggle switches found in earlier years on the dash. The car also had open headlights, so no glass covers. Early E-types had glass covers over their headlights. That was removed for this 1.5 version. The car was detuned due to emissions, but this was for US models. US models went from 3 carburetors to just 2 carburetors. Twin cooling fans were used, and other small visual changes were made around the car. Lots of these changes were due to U.S. safety laws, but they were applied internationally, at least some of them were applied internationally. The detuning was specific to the U.S. because Jaguar was not going to detune every single Jaguar E-Type out there just to match U.S. laws, but some of the changes they just kind of applied universally to keep costs down. Blocking the Series 1 and Series 1.5 together, about 15,540 3.8 liter versions were made, 17,320 4.8 liter versions were made, and about 10,930 2 plus 2 versions were made. So, a decent number. Starting in 1968 to 1971, the Series 2 came out. The Series 2 is very, very similar to the 1.5 series, as changes were just slowly implemented, and so, like I said, transitional change, and so really the Series 2 and Series 1.5 are incredibly similar. The Series 2 has the no cover on the headlights, which is one of those changes that came about due to U.S. safety laws, but then was applied worldwide. Other visual changes included wraparound rear bumper, taillights being placed lower on the car, an enlarged grille, twin electric fans were used, like the 1.5 series. Sadly, the push-button start was replaced with a steering column ignition switch. A collapsible steering column and seats with head restraints were added to improve safety. Again, thanks to U.S. laws. The engine was the same from the 1.5 series, so the detuned 2-carb for U.S. Both horsepower and torque dropped by about 20 due to the loss of that third carburetor. Series 2 had about the same number of cars produced. The total is somewhere between 13,490 and 18,809. I've seen different sources. So somewhere between those two numbers are the number of Series 2 cars out there. Starting in 1971, the Series 3 was created. And the Series 3 is kind of a whole different beast because it was given a 5.0 liter V12. It went from an inline 6 to a V12, so double the number of cylinders. It was fed by 4 Zenith carburetors, which makes sense. There's a lot more cylinders to feed. And power was increased, but not by all that much. It went up to 272 horsepower. The engine, the V12, was not originally designed for the E-Type. Instead, it was meant to go into the XJ Saloon, another Jaguar car, but when you have a V12 just sitting around, it's kind of hard to not just shove it in your lightweight sports car, because that just sounds really fun to do. This was also the time where the Jaguar really became a GT car. They kind of just stopped trying to make it a sports car, really focused on the GT car, so it had a longer wheelbase and was designed for more enjoyable touring, which is not a bad thing. About 15,000 of these Series 3 were made. So by far, Series 1 is the most common, and Series 2 and 3 are less common, but Series 1s are worth more because they're the original. They're, you know, the first E-Type. So where do Jaguar E-Types sit today? If you want one, how attainable are they? They're attainable. They're not incredibly expensive. They're not going to absolutely destroy you financially, but they're still not stupidly cheap. Prices range a lot and have been fluctuating for a few years. The most expensive are Series 1, and if you find one of these in perfect condition, like showroom condition, they can be worth around $400,000, which doesn't make it sound very attainable. However, if you still want one of these cars and don't care all that much about the rarity, I mean, an E-Type is an E-Type, then a Series 2, 2 plus 2, in rough condition, can be had for around $16,000, which isn't too bad. But, of course, it is in rough shape, so you'll have to spend money fixing it up and get it working well again. Speaking of that, I always enjoy project cars. You know, that's really what I'm into. I would probably prefer to work on a car and build a car compared to buying one. So, how expensive are parts? How rare are parts? You know, are you going to break the bank trying to fix one of these? Depends. For general parts, for engine, suspension, transmission, things like that, they're pretty attainable and pretty cheap. So getting an engine rebuilt, getting it running, is definitely possible. Where you can get into a little bit of trouble is bodywork. The E-Type body was hand-built. So that means that the body on one E-Type will never match exactly the body on another E-Type. So that means that you can't really just go out and get a replacement fender or replace the entire body from a different E-Type. They're a bit unique. So repairing the body and getting it looking good is definitely the most expensive part of it. If you don't care about how it looks and you just want it to drive well, you can be pretty set. It's a reasonable car. If you wanted to make it showroom ready with impeccable paint and bodywork, it's definitely a bigger investment. A final note is that this is a British sports car from the 1960s, and while they can be reliable, they are definitely going to need a lot more work than modern cars. Oil changes need to be done extremely regularly, all fluids need to be changed very regularly, and they really need a lot of tender loving and care to not fall apart. It's kind of going to be a full-time job to keep these cars on the road, but when they are working properly and they're happy, they are incredible cars to drive. They may not be as fast as modern cars, but I don't think that modern cars can provide the same driving experience as a Jaguar E-Type. That's going to be it for the Jaguar E-Type. I hope you enjoyed. If you'd like to support the podcast, the number one way to do that is to leave a review or to follow the podcast on whichever platform you are listening, and please do it. I really appreciate it. It means a ton to get some feedback on the content I'm producing. You're also welcome to follow me on my social media. My Instagram is automotive.podcast. My Facebook is at automotivepodcast, and my Twitter is at automotivepod. I post car facts and will let you know about upcoming episodes. Although I do want to be fair to you guys and to be honest, school is kicking my butt a little bit, so the social media is definitely a little bit dead currently. My apologies, I will work to get it up and running, but it probably won't be until May when summer starts. So you're welcome to give me a follow, and I will try to produce content for it, but we'll see how that goes. Other than that, thank you again for listening. I really do appreciate it, and I will see you next week.